They are. In my palmy days, I would accept 60 kids in a class. I would have taken the whole school if I could get them. But the theory of formal pedagogy that we learn from being taught is wrong in anybody's experience. We learn from self-teaching. There's some utility in having a coach, but nobody can educate you, and no school can educate you. It's a commitment you make to yourself. Now, what's happened in the public mind, though, is the propaganda of the institution has conveyed a false image of what an education is. It's not memorizing bits of fact, not factoids. It's not passing bogus standardized exams. I understand you have one called the tertiary.
Tertiary entrance examination.
None of these standardized exams, none of them for the past 100 years, has ever been able to be correlated with later success in any aspect of life unless the game is rigged. So you only allow people to compete who've achieved a certain level on the standardized exam. There have been in the United States 78 major studies, some of which cost millions of dollars, desperately attempting to show that the standardized exam measures distinctions of quality. Not one of them has ever succeeded. I entered school teaching utterly believing that the bell curve, I don't know if that jargon term is over here, but it is, I see by your nods, that the bell curve was a kindness to the lesser folk. And 3 years of school teaching showed me what garbage that was as I imposed humane techniques based on bell curve data in this kid's records. The kids ate me alive, and finally, the way they ate every other teacher alive who did it. So I told my wife, listen, this is so boring that what I'm going to do is employ the exact techniques that were employed on me in two elite private universities in the United States. Inside of 3 weeks, kids would follow me through the hall 30 and 40 at a time there, and I had upgraded the curriculum from Dick and Jane to Moby Dick with no difficulty at all. It was a revelation for me, and that was 30-odd years ago, 35 years ago. And each year after that, I explored how far you could push ordinary kids, and I never found the limit.
John, let me just ask you, Simon Beaumont, how are you? John, you did teach for a number of years in Manhattan, as you described, in some of the worst schools in Manhattan as well. Yeah. Just so we're comparing apples with apples,
sure.
How does the American education system, and I'm assuming we're talking about primary school and high school kids primarily here, how does the American education system compare with ours from what you've seen in your time here?
Well, there's a degree of civility here that is unknown anywhere in the United States. So that's, if I say off-putting, it's confusing to a fellow who's used to conflict and contention on every level of schooling. I taught in Manhattan in one of the wealthiest sections on planet Earth, the Upper West Side of Manhattan. So the sons and daughters of the powerful classes and the media classes were in schools jammed together with kids from Black Harlem and Spanish Harlem. They weren't jammed together in the same classes. They traveled in these little spacesuit bubbles. They passed each other. And what they learned was to despise each other. And I came to believe that one of the goals of the system was to do that, was to establish clearly and firmly class distinctions. But I did get a very eclectic bunch of kids to experiment on. I hope that's not as cold-blooded as it sounded. And I came to the conclusion, painfully and slowly, that there was so little difference between the poorest, most ignorant kid in the school and the son of a judge or the mayor, for that matter, that you'd be better off attacking the problem of learning as if everyone was equal than trying to make these fine distinctions based on very spurious pedagogical theory. And the result of it was I ended up 3 times the New York City Teacher of the Year and 2x the New York State Teacher of the Year.
Can you give us a few examples, John? How did your teaching methods differ from what we would sort of traditionally think as...
Well, I brought in a class newspaper so that your viewers could see through the medium of imaginative radio. This is the record of 6 weeks. Every 6 weeks, we produced a record of what this class of 60 kids did. And before I launch into this, I know that your listeners will be interested to know, especially the teachers, how I assembled these 60 kids. I started with 4 kids who scored off the scale on standardized exams.
Right.
And I matched them with 4 holdovers who had flunked the previous year. And then we marched down from the top, up from the bottom, until the median and the average were exactly an 8th grade level, a middle school level. But in fact, it was a teacher's nightmare. No one was, in fact, the same. There were 5 or 6 major cultures jammed together, all hostile to one another in the class. So how was it that in a relatively short time, I mean, these kids were dazzling the city. Those of you who don't have a way into this studio should see that the very first article in this newspaper that came out every 6 weeks is Pizza Palace sued, 13-year-old wins case in first court appearance. And what's pictured in the article is a 13-year-old black kid from Harlem, a straight C student, who had the audacity to go to a pizza parlor that was in the shadow of one of America's ritziest private day schools, the collegiate school where John F. Kennedy's kid was going. So the pizza owner, in horror, grabbed his pizza and his soda, threw it away, and threw him out. Not because he was black, but because if public school kids started to use that venue, that was the end of the kids with blue blazers and brass buttons, a good carriage trade. Well, the boy came to me, and he was in tears, and he was furious. And he said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, A, I'm not going to do anything, but you have a recourse through the courts. It only costs $3.50 to argue your own case." This was 1980 in the American courts. However, decent people wouldn't dream of going to law without giving somebody who had made a mistake a second chance. I mean, you've had bad days, Jerome. Maybe he had a bad day. Why don't you go to the telephone and call him and say that you're the kid who got his pizza thrown away, and you're willing to let bygones be bygones if he gives you your pizza back.
Yeah, yeah.
As I stood there, the guy hung the phone up on Jerome. I said, "Good, Jerome, I'm going to produce an affidavit for you saying that I witnessed you attempt to solve this reasonably. Now can we sue him?" Jerome said, "No." I said, "You're going to give him a second chance. That's what decent people do. So this time, you're going to go over in person, and you're going to say, at a non-busy hour, and you're going to say, 'I don't want to make trouble. Just give me my slice of pizza back.' Everyone has bad days." So poor Jerome comes back. He threw me out again. "Okay, Jerome, I'm going to give you a second affidavit. And now," I said, "you're going to go to the post office and send him a letter, certified return receipt requested. In those days, it cost 65 cents. And you're going to say that you'll give him 10 days simply to make good. And after that, you'll be forced to take him to court." Well, Jerome not only won triple damages. No one went with him. There wasn't a delegation. The court was 17 miles from the school. He went down and got the warrant, filed the papers, and then he went down and argued the case. He was the only one of the two in front of the referee able to demonstrate that he had attempted to act reasonably. And I told him that's the key to all small claims adjudications. Whoever shows evidence that they can, well, Jerome graduated, I don't know, 5-6 years ago from Duke University Law School. This is a straight C student from Harlem who had never eaten off a tablecloth in his life. That one break into the real universe led to calls first on a daily basis from colleges, from judges, from lawyers, taking Jerome out to find out who this kid was.
So the real-world application there is a lot more important than just the textbook application.
It's not only a lot more important, Liam. It is essential. What we've done is reduce the growing up period to an unbroken diet of abstraction and low-level abstraction at that. As a consequence, the only people who survive that tour are people whose homes are culturally rich and politically adversarial, you know, debates at the dinner table.
What were restricted? What through what you're saying are restrictive educational formats, and also TV and the commercial world.
TV and school do precisely the same job. I mean, the formats are different, but basically, you're told, let's suppose it's a public broadcasting show about the red deer of Scotland. And they're fascinating and they're well made. But the truth is, you're not seeing the red deer of Scotland. You're seeing one cameraman and one director's take on a red deer that appealed to them. And you're told what to think about this. You're told what the issues are. Now, that would be harmless if we had developed a dialectical mind in our kids. But for people who are used to memorizing in order to pass examinations, it's fatal to the development of an independent consciousness, which basically means that the whole world of opportunity in small business, in entrepreneurial ventures, in bold departures from what you're expected to do is wiped out for most people. The great resource of Australia or New York City or Pittsburgh, where I come from, the great resource has been wasted. We're operating these societies on 10 or 15% of the available talent because it's easier to do that. It's safer for the established classes. It's more convenient for the corporate mind because you can then predict what these people will buy and how to spook them one way or another.
We're talking to John Taylor Gatto, who is a keynote speaker at the Perth Convention Centre this week in the Checking the Pulse National Education Conference here in Perth. John, let me ask you this. Liam and I, perhaps, but you're talking about more innovative and liberated teaching experiences for kids. Sure. Liam and I both have young kids who are starting off on their learning, their education experiences. What I'm concerned about is I want my kid, after he comes out at the end of the 12 years or whatever it is, I want him to be able to function in a mainstream society and get a job and get on and be successful.
And make friends.
And be happy and healthy and all those sorts of things. How can I, if I put him into an alternative teaching or a liberated or an innovative teaching scheme, how do I know that my young bloke's going to come out in 12 years and will be able to function in mainstream society?
Well, fortunately, I can answer that with some hard data. There are other ways to answer it. But over the past 25 years, from a base of 10,000 families, 2 million families in the United States have removed their children from institutional schooling and schooled them at home. 2 million. So that's a phenomenal growth rate. And I've had the privilege of being the keynote speaker at 38 of those homeschool conventions. Some of them are religiously based, but many of them are thoroughly secular. What they're frightened of is the slow movement through even the best public schools and even through most of the private schools. Not all. There are excellent private schools. There are excellent religious schools. But in the main, public schools, religious schools, and private schools tend to follow the same format. It's probably some imitative aspect, whatever, I won't speculate on why. What I've been able to see is how far and how fast it's possible for kids from all walks of life to go, as long as the early experience is experience-based rather than abstraction and rather than funny faces, balloons, pretty colors, singing. The North Germans invented that particular system in the early part of the 19th century deliberately because they knew that if you can't get the development of mind and independent character early, it's not ever going to happen reliably. That is, it'll appear, but it won't have any roots to it. So the Prussians, the Saxons, and the Hanoverians reduced the elementary grades to a kind of mindless play. And of course, from the kids' point of view, coming from strict German homes, this was heaven. This was paradise. And they ended up the most obedient, most efficient military cadre probably in world history, because they didn't know how to do anything but be obedient for very long.
But John, the practical aspect of this, I mean, you know, it is just not practical, is it, for many people to opt out of the rigid, the sort of standardized system, whether they want to or not.
Well, Liam, I've misled you. You don't have to remove your body to remove your spirit and to use the daily experience of, say, a public school the way an anthropologist would. So your kid has constant raw material to process. Why? How are these things different? You know, what does this mean? What are the dynamics at work? My contention is that if you...
You're really just talking about getting a child to ask why instead of feeding them with rote learning, aren't you?
To absolutely think dialectically. Aristotle, writing 2,300 years ago, said that people who can't think dialectically, this is in the Politics, aren't really human beings at all. They just look like human beings. Well, there are half a dozen different dialectics, but basically it means that you don't accept any contention that you hold them in suspension. You're not defiant, but you don't accept those as operating principles of your life until you've had some opportunity to test them and verify them privately.
John, let's take some questions for you, shall we? Janine's first up. Hello, Janine.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. My question, I'm actually studying to be a middle years teacher, and I've nearly finished my study. And what I find is that the communication between teachers and that old primary school versus high school mentality of teachers is the most difficult thing I deal with. And I wondered, first of all, whether it's the same in America and whether your keynote speaker, who I've been listening to, but I don't remember his name, whether he has any insight on that.
My name's John.
Hi, John.
And my old friends call me Jack.
Hi, Jack.
Hi, Janine. The culture of schools, now I'm speaking with zero knowledge of Australian schools at all, but the culture of institutions is always highly politicized, and the older members are always under threat from the newer ones who bring in new ideas, new techniques, or who question things that the older folk don't want questioned. So, yes, I ran into this everywhere, and I was the union leader in my last school. It was everywhere.
Do you think that with the way middle school sort of approaches pedagogy from the point of view of an integrated learning and team teaching and working, you know, with a bigger group of kids with several teachers, do you think, this is my hope, in the long run that will overcome some of that attitude? Do you think that's likely?
It certainly will make the job easier for teachers in the business. But as for better results other than placidity from the kids, I would be extremely dubious. The difference between a schooling and an education is really rudimentary. A schooling is imposed from without. It's a habit training system more than anything else, and a ranking system. An education is created from the inside out. Teachers in our way of teaching do 90% of the work. That's a schooling. In an educational system, the kids do 90% of the work. And since you can't do that if you confine 20 or 30 or 40 of them in one room, you have to disperse them. You have to trust them to want the best for themselves and not to run down to the pub and hoist one.
Janine, thanks very much for your question. Hello, Mary.
Oh, hello. Yes, I'd just like to put a question to Jack. You know, everyone is like Simon and Liam. We all just are desperately wanting the best for our children, Jack. And I'm just wondering, how do you, how do you stop from, you know, teaching your children what you want to get them to, I don't know how, if you can, you know, draw it out of themselves, what they are finding interesting or, you know, in the learning process. Can you answer something to that?
Sure. Mary, I'm speaking
that's
to?
Right.
Pardon me?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, Mary, let me take the single most prestigious scientific job in the world today. Nothing else is remotely close to it. It's the Human Genome Project. Every corporation on the face of this planet is lined up to get filthy rich from human genome discoveries. Who do you imagine is in charge of the Human Genome Project? That's a rhetorical question. I'm going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a guy who never went to school, who lived on a remote sheep ranch in Western Virginia, who had no interest in science at all, and followed this type of curriculum and methodology. He and his mother, on this remote sheep ranch, studied anything they felt like studying for as long as they felt like studying it. And when they were bored, they picked something else. They didn't follow a balanced diet. They didn't take tertiary examinations.
Yeah, but there's two supplementary questions there. Is he a genius and how capable was she?
Well, I can't answer that question. I'm operating from a playing field where after 30 years in the classroom, I think what we call human genius is as common as dirt. It's everywhere. What we've worked out over centuries are ways to keep this obvious fact from interfering with the social order or the economic order. I think genius is everywhere, and I certainly didn't enter the business thinking that way.
Okay. Mary, good question. Thanks for that.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good morning, Rebecca.
Hi. Sorry, I'll just turn my radio down. I did the typical thing at the age of 18 and went and studied teaching and dropped out at the beginning of my third year of studies for basically the same reasons that are being discussed today. And I've spent the last 3 years working as a trainer with long-term unemployed people and discovered that exactly what I thought is true. They don't know how to learn. They don't want to. There's no passion, blah, 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 blah. So I'm about to return to my teaching studies, hoping that I can create the love of learning in young people. How can I do this in the typical system?
Well, the first way, although it's not a complete answer, is yourself to love learning. If you do,
I do, yeah.
I absolutely guarantee you that most of the kids will catch on to the fact that you're personally having a ball, and you tell them that over and over again. I come to this classroom not for my pitiful paycheck, but because I learn as much as I teach. It's an exchange. So they pick up on that rather than the dry formulae of traditional pedagogy. The other way is to assume what you know about yourself. everybody has a passion.
Mm.
But it doesn't have to be your passion. And you can't say, if you exercise my passion first, then I will let you exercise yours. Pick whatever it is that you see that they love to yep. do. And everyone loves to do something, even if it's only
the
sleep.
And the English around it. Is that what you're thinking?
Well, look, if you go into a Harlem school, those are all black schools in New York City, I guarantee you from the first day on, half of the boys in the class will be drawing from comic books.
Yeah.
Half of them will be doing that. Well, in New York City, the capital of the comic book business on planet Earth, there are actual comic companies.
Mm.
Graphic art, which is comic drawing, is a major form of making a very good living.
Mm.
There, why not use the city and the comic industry as your textbook?
Yeah.
Don't be misled by people who say, but how will they learn how a bill becomes a law? Or how will they learn quadratic equations? I guarantee you that once somebody is launched into passionate learning, they'll learn everything very quickly when they need to know it.
Rebecca, thanks for that.
Okay, thank you.
I've got to move on. Just want to get through these two last questions. John, Sonny, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks, Jack. My background is probably similar to yours. My mother was a teacher in the States. I'm now 60 and coming back into it. She was given the golden handshake a year before she was due to retire because she refused to define in tabular form which children required Ritalin. That was in the 50s. I'm frustrated working with kids so-called at risk. I hate to use that term to the children themselves. Trying to empower them and develop that love of learning that you speak of. Is there? Can you talk a little bit about the pills that we're trying to give kids to dumb them down?
Yeah. Let me step in though with your last statement to show kids a love of learning. You can't do that in a bulk process way. You can't exhort classes to love learning. It's a negotiation man to man or man to woman or.
We take them out on the Bibelman track and we look at stuff.
That's good, but how many people are you taking out to look at
four
stuff?
Four at a time.
Four.
Yeah.
That sounds okay, though.
Much better.
All right. Now, Ritalin, I'll be addressing at tomorrow's conference. In the United States, there are, I believe, 8 million schoolchildren on Ritalin or on a number of analogous substances, and I've encountered hundreds of them. I mean, literally hundreds of them. What Ritalin does is shut the kid up.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the kid passive, and therefore, in what otherwise is an intractable, horrifying confinement situation, the kid will sit there with a dumb grin on his face and stare straight ahead.
Absolutely.
Does it have an actually positive medical effect? Hey, I'm not a doctor, but I'll tell you flatly no. Pharmacologically, these substances are very, very similar to street drugs.
That's right.
Now, that's a great secret that we don't bother to tell parents there. You pump them full of drugs, and that way they get through the day. Does that have a long-term good effect? Hey, would I tell an Australian?
Yeah, Sonny.
Thank you.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks very much. John, just the final call. Ken, good morning.
Good morning, Liam. I would just like to talk about a man called Chris Sara in Queensland. He was featured on Australian Story last week.
Yeah, I saw that. It's a good program, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely fantastic. The way he took this school from an absolute basket case that they were going to close down and instilled in those children a love of learning, a want to get out there and succeed. It was absolutely inspiring, I thought.
He was Teacher of the Year in Queensland. He's also Citizen of the Year too, wasn't he, Ken?
That's correct, yes, and he's currently doing his doctorate, I think.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about his American counterpart. A math teacher named Jaime Escalante, who was very prominent in world school circles about 10 or 15 years ago, because he took a class of kids, illiterate kids from one of the 20 worst schools in California. And inside of 1 year, he made them the top performing calculus class in the state of California and the number three calculus class in the entire United States. That includes elite private boarding schools. Jaime Escalante wasn't an American. He was an overage Peruvian immigrant who wore a golf cap, but he knew one thing that the standard calculus teachers don't know. He knew that calculus is about exactly the examination of two ideas, motion and change. And given that simple core, he was able, in short order, to take kids who had never eaten off a tablecloth and who could barely read and make them the best in the United States. Now, the reason Escalante was driven out of his school wasn't because he was a pederast or drank too much Foster's. He was driven out of his school because the example held up a mirror to all the other teachers of elite mathematical subjects who would say, I can only deal with the best of the best. It's a cruelty to inflict this on other kids. There's a movie about this guy, and you could rent it in Australia, called Stand and Deliver.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've seen that. You've seen that, haven't you?
Yep. Yeah, I have. Yeah. All right, Ken, good on you. And lots of great calls there, Lam. Fascinating subject, isn't it?
Mm. So. John, thanks very much for coming in and having a chat to us.
This has been a real pleasure, and thank you for being gentlemen. Australians who get exported to the States often aren't, but right here on the homeland, they genuinely are.
Good luck at the Checking the Pulse National Education Conference, John. Yeah. And importantly, good luck at the casino, too.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. John Taylor Gatto. It's on at the Perth Convention Centre tomorrow, and John's keynote speech will be delivered at about 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and all are welcome.